You can buy them on Amazon.com.
Buy them on Amazon.
This was not sponsored by Amazon.com. Please click my affiliate link below.
No. Oh my gosh. Give up your dream, Jonathan. Don't you're never going to become an Amazon affiliate. Alrighty, y'all. Time for another Threat Locker lockdown story, okay? Picture this. You're on an internal pen test and you finally got a foothold on a target machine. You've reached the point where it's time to snoop around a little bit and see if you can find these little juicy pieces of information that allow you to pivot deeper into the network. You open up the desktop and what do you see? But what every hacker loves to see? Passwords.txt file. You type cat or type or whatever it is on Windows to get the contents of that file. And just as you press enter, the shell drops. No, why did the shell drop? That, my friend, was a ThreatLocker canary file. And that machine is now on complete lockdown. You're burnt. End scene. I know that was traumatic, you all, but I had to let you know what kind of things ThreatLocker Detect is doing to hackers. So if you or a loved hacker has experienced trauma at the hands of ThreatLocker systems, please call the ThreatLocker hacker complaint number at 833-292-7732. All right, guys, let's go back to the show. All righty, Dr. Bowman, the time has come. Thank you for coming back on the pod, man.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, I got to have Bowman on, and I realized we actually did have you on in an episode back in the beginning of the podcast, episode 17, with all those hackers just kind of sitting in a hotel room chatting about all the bug stories. So that was definitely a great memory of mine.
That's a good memory. Yeah, it was just some smallish hotel room all on the batch because there was not more space there. And yeah, I think I described some bugs that had me to create a music song and get it released and all the hassle to get through to get it actually there where I wanted it to pop. But it was a good time. And I'm so honored that you guys still use it in the podcast.
Dude, we use it every episode. I think people really like it at the end. You know, it's, you know, because you go through the full podcast, the intro music is really like, all right, let's hype it up. And then at the end, it's like, okay, now we're just going to mellow it out right at the end, right?
To be one of the two, like Whitey Cracker and me. Wow.
Yeah.
Standing in the credits next to Whitey Cracker. Come on.
It adds to your list of achievements, man, which is where I wanted to start today. Cause it's like, I think you're probably one of the most unique hackers in our space. You know, obviously Bug Bounty has a lot of variance in the people that are participating in it by nature of what it is. You know, anybody can participate. There's no limits on that. But to see someone be a medical doctor and also do Bug Bounty is pretty mind-blowing. So I'm wondering, you know, which one of those did you have interest in first? And how did you... You know, Hop, how did you simultaneously become very good at both of these things?
Well, thanks. You make me a little bit shy there, but so to start with, I think most hackers start when they're young. It's the state of mind of like, how does this work? How to find the boundaries of this thing that I'm using, if it's a computer game or some software at school. So yeah, it all started when I was real young, say 12 years old, 13 years old, when you start building websites or start figuring out how internet works. So I can't say, oh, I was first a doctor and then a hacker. No, I think I was starting real young there, and I was developing websites and trying to understand how search engine optimizations work. But if you have to ask me nowadays, what am I? I will tell you I'm a doctor. And the hacking thing, that is something that came into my life about 6 years ago. So before that time, I did med school. And during med school, you have to earn some money because it's expensive. You have to live on your own in some big cities. So that's when I started to build up websites, e-commerce things, startups. So I was responsible for some big auctioning website in the Netherlands, some big crowdfunding website.
Oh, very interesting.
So I learned from the full stack developer perspective how to handle a lot of data, PII data, and how to do it a little bit secure. It was all PHP at the time, so that's a challenge. But still, you learn a lot. And after that, I went to work as a street doctor 3 days a week, 2 days a week, startups. And then at one moment, I became a GP, and that is a special training of 3 years. Just like a surgeon, you need 6 years, as a GP, 3 years in their labs. And they forbid me to do any side gigs, any external jobs, because they say, we pay your training, so we want you to focus on it, which is okay. But a hacker never stops thinking as a hacker. So at one moment, mid of my trainings, I went to this, I can say this group where all the doctors come together that they are in the training, and my supervisor was there as well. And I asked him, like, hey, is there a possibility that I could do some variation of chess matches online? And if I win them, then I might earn a prize. It's not like a guaranteed income. And is that an option? Can you do sports, actually? And they were like, yeah, internet sports, that's all. But it exists as some sort of chess. They said, yeah, it's some sort of chess. So they gave me permission to do that. And that was actually good money. So as soon as I saw on the national TV, some young guy, Sherbin, is his name. Shout out to Forbin if he listened to the podcast. I'm not sure, I've never met him in person. And Forbin was a book bookbub in there, and on the national television, he mentioned, like, yeah, some people say book bounties is hard, but I earned 10K a weekend for finding books. And I was like, this guy, so young, how does he do that? So that was the moment for me to introduce this to my supervisors, and they said, yeah, let's give it a ride. So that's when it all started.
So you know, at this time you're in training for being a GP, and you're not allowed to do side gigs, but you figure out a way to make this side gig, a game, a gamble, a risk maybe, that has some monetary incentive. All right, thinking like a hacker. I love it, dude. Yeah. I wonder why you decided to go down the route of medicine when you were clearly passionate about hacking and tinkering and computer stuff for this whole duration as well, right? Like, typically what most people will do, most people have a hard enough time coming up with one thing that they're passionate about, and really going ham at that. But you identified, you went the medical route and the hacking route. So what made you do that instead of just picking IT and sticking with it, or picking, medicine and sticking with that?
Yeah. So the honest answer is, I was 17 years old and I was almost done with the last year in high school. So that's the moment where you go to different university to have a look around. So I went to this introduction course on artificial intelligence, actually. Mm. And I went there with one of my best friends who, later on ended up at OpenAI as one of their first employees. Super proud of him still. But I went with him there, and I sat down in this big, big theater where all the students come together. And then the person in front of the theater started the introduction and said, I'm so happy this year, of the 400 interested people, 4 females sign up. And this was a moment of crisis to me. It was like, okay, wait, John, you're quite good in computers. You're not really interested in girls, but you now might sign up for a world with your own males. And that was a problem at the time. These days, it's less of a thing, and that's super good.
Yeah.
But I'm an old guy. I'm 37. So in the day, say 18 years ago, this was a problem. So this was when I went back to the drawing board, and I was like, okay, if I want to live in a world with only guys, they will become my best friends and I will have a great time. But I might prefer a more diverse world to work in for the last, for the upcoming 40 years. And so I started thinking about what was the most interesting thing in high school, stuff that I can't really understand and I would love to learn more about, because this is the moment in life that I can do that. Besides computers and hacking and AI and that sort of stuff, I figured out biology is the thing. I had such a good teacher at the time that it was so inspiring. It was one of those people you meet in life. Everyone got a few of them. But this biology teacher made me decide to do med school. And I was quite lucky since you have to sign up for med school, you do some interviews, and it was a lottery at the time, so I had to be lucky. But I was placed in some university in Amsterdam and start doing that. And it was the best choice maybe in my young youth, because you learn so much, not only about biology, but also about ethics, about communication, about what matters in life. And till this day, I'm super grateful that I can do this work, because it shows you how short life is, how important it is to enjoy every good minute of it, but also help others out and share your luck, share your insights, and just try to make the best of it. So yeah, that's a little bit of the background of that.
That makes sense. I mean, I definitely felt that draw as well, just as I don't know that I've talked about this on the pod before, but, you know, back when I was in college, up until, I guess, 2 years past when you start college in the US, you can still sort of change and go to a different route. And even though I was really into like computer science and hacking stuff in college, I was a part of a leadership program, and most of the other people in the leadership program were med students. And so they were talking to me, and my grades were really good, particularly in chemistry. And they were like, Justin, you know, a very programmatic thinking computer science guy with, you know, really good grades in chemistry would make a really killer med school application. And I'm like, I sat there for a second and I was like, man, I would love to help people. You know, yeah. I would love to be able to, you know, be a part of saving people's life or you know, giving people their health back. And I was close, man. I was very close to going down that route. So I definitely, when I see you on the scene, I'm like, this is what could have been potentially.
You can still become maybe one. I'm not sure in your country how it works, but in med school, when I was there, there were also people of 30 plus, 40 plus even there. It costs a little bit more money, but it's a possibility. And I'm sure you will be a great doctor. And with you, there's plenty of good money hunters actually that think like doctors, but they're not aware that they do. Since what you guys do, what we do as big money hunters, we do recon. Well, this doctor where you're sitting in front of is also doing recon on you. And it's not going to pull a fuss on you on 1,000 threads and withdraw all your blood and check it for everything. No, because you will end up with too much false positives or collapsing patients, just like a server that is crashing because of doing too much recon. And so you pinpoint, you do the specific nuclei templates on this human body, and then you get some signal back, and then you start figuring out what's going on, and you're connecting the dots. That's what big bounty hunters do, connecting dots and finding risk groups. In other words, certain types of services that are running, trying to figure out systemic problems that exist in all different humans. Yeah, that's what we do as well as doctors, systemic issues. As bipartisans, we look for sandbox Chrome instances making screenshots and then breaking out of them. Doctors do the same. We are thinking like, oh, wait a minute, this disease looks like that disease and it exists everywhere. So we need to poke into those sandboxes of the human body and see what's going on. So there's so many similarities. I'm sure if we convert a lot of bipartisans tomorrow into doctors, and that will be great. We'll be a really interesting thing.
That'd be pretty cool. And I think there's a lot about bug bounty that can feel pretty like, I don't know, like green hat, right? Like you're just in it for the money. And in some scenarios, bug bounty hunters are notoriously like that. And I think it's refreshing to see your take on bug bounty combined with, you know, this whole ethics piece as well, because I know that plays a big part with you, you know, in your perception of the situation from a doctor's perspective, right? You know, you have taken an oath to try to care for these patients, and in a similar way, I know you're applying a lot of that technical stuff to the medicine space, trying to protect the patients, trying to protect the doctors, and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, there's power in the Bugdani world as well, you know, being able to find and exploit these vulnerabilities, and you want to use that for positive means to try to make the world safer and care for the people in it.
Yeah, it's a part I forgot in the during the training of becoming a GP, one of the main reasons for also trying the Bugdani thing is it's the thing you actually just described. I'm trained as a doctor to see if some treatment or some tablets or some injection has more benefits than risks. So I only want to give you good treatments and don't cause you harm. And I'm not trained to assess computer systems as a doctor, but I prescribe them nonstop. I give you e-learnings. I send forms to you. I invite you to my portals. I connect systems. Yeah. And so I'm not trained to that. And I have to trust the blue eyes of all those people doing a great job on putting certificates on all those applications and infrastructure. But the proof is in the pudding. And I want to see it myself if it's really working. And the best school to go to is Bugdani, since there is the place where you learn actually what happens. What is the bugs of tomorrow? What are the bugs of today? And what to look for? So I don't say certificates and ISOs and whatever is not good. No, it's part of your way to defend yourself. But the last resort is Bugdani's, and you need to be able to think out of the box, poke from different directions. And I think pen testing is limited often by scope, and Bugdani's still a little bit limited by scope, but more and more the scopes are widening up, and that is perfect, because then you can connect the dots again, think like a real hacker, and see how this patient or doctor is vulnerable actually, or the other weak groups we have. And there's good money. So my disclosure, I'm always honest about that. I earned 95% of my money with Bugdani. So only 5% is with being a doctor and stuff like that. And it's not a number I tell people to show off. No, it's just my conflicts of interest. So I've got a big interest in also pushing the Bugdani, but I think for a good cause. In healthcare, it's almost non-existing.
Well, and enlighten me a little bit about how this works in European countries, because in the US, like, doctors normally make a pretty good amount of money. It's one of the higher paying things. And I think that's probably a lot because of the stupid system we have over here, where everything in healthcare is ridiculously inflated, right? And not to say that doctors shouldn't make a lot of money. I think they should, because they're doing a big service. But I think there's also this aspect where I believe in European countries it's a little bit different, where being like a doctor is perceived more as like a public service sort of thing.
Sort of. It most doctors in the Netherlands work for the public health, as we say. So it's you're forced to pay for insurance, healthcare insurance. That's by law a thing you need to do, and then you can also access this healthcare. And doctors aren't good in the Netherlands. No misunderstandings about that. But to give a figure, it's like if you're a well-earning doctor, it's 100K max. And maybe there are exceptions there, but it's still a lot of money. But for working 5 days a week, being vulnerable to all different types of lawsuits, and having to be always on top of stuff and don't make mistakes, that's
putting yourself at risk too. You know, you're dealing with a lot of sick people. You know, you're gonna get
so
sick.
Scary.
Like, I imagine so, dude. That must have been terrifying. So, that definitely makes sense. And it makes sense that you would be out earning that in Bugdani a lot, because the way that I've seen it, you've been really crushing it. And let's go ahead and pivot into that arena now. And I want to pick your brain on, you know, your approach to Bugdani programs and that sort of thing. And I also want to swing back around to some of how the way that you approach some of this health related stuff in Bugdani as well, you know, making sure you're keeping your body energized and how you've been able to continue for such a long amount of time in Bugdani, with high performance with that. But let's jump over to the hacking stuff, real quick. Hey guys, our sponsor, Project Discovery, has dropped a new tool in collaboration with Google's own Mandiant team called TLD Finder. Okay, picture the sub finder, but for top-level domains. Need I say any more? Check it out. Okay, so we can talk about the fact that Amazon is your primary program. And you've been pretty much exclusively hacking on Amazon for the past, what?
6 years, I think.
5-6 years?
Yeah.
Really?
My initial idea was to get rich quickly on Amazon from scroll.am. You can still go to this website. I think it's still online. I hope my SSL works. And if you go there, you see an animating GIF of how the site used to work. And what I did is I created some front end, some lockdown back end services that misused in the end the API of the Amazon app and created some Pinterest look on Amazon. So no UI distractions, just you can enter something, boom, you saw the products. So that's when I thought, like, okay, if I do this, put referral links on them, I get rich easily because I get this affiliate thing of 10% of everything that this bought in the next days. This failed miserably because after 4 days, I was banned from the affiliate program on Amazon. But during you should embed their content on your website and not create content that is solely their content. That was one of the real things. Can happen. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about JavaScript frameworks and about Lambda and microservices and stuff like that, and to scale it up in such a way that it does not burn a lot of money. But during that time, I had to detect the Android app of Amazon. And while doing I found some endpoint that was vulnerable to Reflected XSS. And by today, that's still the only Amazon report that is disclosed on Medium, I think. So if you Google it, you can find it. It's some really, really fancy payload with GSFuck is, I think, the name of the payload generator. But I found some bugs, so I emailed them, like, hey, there's an XSS there. You banned me, so you might be able to unban me, but okay, I understand it's in your terms and condition, so fair game, but you need to fix this bug. So they replied back, thank you, and bye. And then it was silent for 1 year, and then suddenly some guy emailed me from the Amazon security department, Hao Wang. He was one of the founders of the bug bounty program of Amazon, and he was like, Jonathan, do you want to become part of some experiment of us?
Oh, snap.
Tell me, what type of experiment? Yeah. We want to create a group that might in the trust. You could be one of them.
And I love that name, by the way. Like, it's so dramatic. It's like, okay, sure.
It's brilliant. A lot of mites and stuff. It's like, this makes sense. If I go to the bar and in a bar and I tell a girl, hey, I'm Jonathan, I'm part of Knights in the Trust. I'm in Knights for finding bugs on a website. But, so I said yes. And that was the moment that I start reporting bugs to them, earning points, and with those points, gift cards.
So you were, I guess, I didn't know this. You were actually one of the preliminary people, one of the first people to be a part of Amazon's bug bounty programs. And was that something they were just running privately at that point? Yeah. Were they running it through HackerOne? No, were they like, how was that working?
Bug crowd.
Bug crowd.
Yeah. So, nice. So that's where I started. And trying to find more XSS and all the OWASP top 10 bugs, learning a lot of stuff. And that's the moment where at some point I had 100 points. And with 100 points, you earned the certificate.
Oh snap. Okay, here we go.
And this certificate, there's something really important. I received it. I was really proud. I opened up the box and let me try to find it. I got it somewhere behind.
Go see if you can find it. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's something fun there. Yeah, I found it.
Nice.
So there was a moment that I received this thing and have a look at the logo.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you look closely, it's number 2. It's not number 1. So I was like, who's this number 1 guy?
Number 2? What is this? What is this?
And that was the moment I started doing some all-ins on the internet, having a look around, putting it on Twitter, looked on LinkedIn, and I found out there's a guy named Zishano.
Oh, snap. No way.
Number 1. And I was like, holy shit. Who is this guy? And what did he do? So I got in touch with him. We had immediately a great fun. Like, oh no, you found this bug. I also found I duped you there. And but what we discovered that only maybe 1% of the bugs we found, we duped each other, but the 99% we did not. So somehow we did different things there. So we had some, say, 6-7 months where we raced each other in the charts, and then he topped me, then I topped him, and then he topped me, and then topped him. And at one moment, we figured out it might be more fun if we collab here and just join forces, since we both do a different thing, but we might have unfinished bugs that we can finish for each other. And so that's all how it all started.
So at this point, I mean, you've connected with Zeeshan. Oh, that's great, right? And so I'm wondering here, like, what is, you've only had your experience with just the Amazon program, right? Like, you haven't been poking around on other bug bounty programs. So, I mean, once you started getting money out of it, like, were you like, okay, maybe I should look around at this other bug bounty thing and start going to these other programs? Or were you always just so locked into Amazon?
At the time, I was more busy with discovering new techniques, and Amazon was helping me with that, but it was also more. So if you look on my Medium blog, you'll see disclosures about IKEA, Philips, all different sort of.
Yeah, IKEA, that's right.
And that was not about money. It was also, it was primarily about learning new stuff, and also just discovering how it all worked. There was also disclosure. Mm. The Amazon, in the beginning, that was all earning points. So say the first 6 months, that was...
So you were just doing it for fun.
Yeah, it was fun, but I got gift boxes with Kindles. And at one point, I got invited to DEF CON. So that was the first big prize I got there. So I went there with my brother. I booked a hotel room, got an email back from the Amazon team. Please book a better hotel room and send the invoice again. So I booked a better hotel room.
Oh, snap, dude.
That
feels nice.
Yeah, I felt like a celebrity. So I went to Las Vegas with my little brother there and had a great time at DEF CON and hang around with the Amazon team, which was super small. It was Hawaii and some other people. Lee Bunker. And that's when I also start doing more and also look around a little bit. So I had some Netflix, maybe a few bucks. And,
sure.
But my focus was Amazon all the time because the scope is so big and so complex.
Mm. Yeah. So that's kind of what I want to double click into a little bit more as well is, like, you know, I think there are very few programs on which it's feasible for you to spend 6 years and still be finding bugs out the wazoo. I mean, you guys found around 100 bugs together, you and Zeeshan, at this last event, which is unbelievable. And so, I mean, do you think that the biggest thing that Amazon has going in its favor for that sort of engagement is the fact that the scope is just so massive and you're constantly finding new applications? Or is it the speed at which they're putting code or the interactions with the researchers? What is Amazon doing that has been able to keep your attention for 6 years?
They have a realistic scope, in my opinion. So their tech service is quite big. They understand that their tech service is quite big. One of their goals is to be aware of the new bugs as soon as possible. So that's why they have good interactions with me as a researcher. I know their weak spots, so I monitor for the weak spots. I know what they find important with the stuff they don't find important. And yeah, it's a good program to me because it's so complex to run one of the biggest companies in the world, all digital, with tons of employees, tons of talented people trying new innovations. And with every innovation, there's some risk of something going wrong. And that's where we jump in as bug bounty hunters to make them aware of the risks. And it never stops.
How are you aware of this innovation? Are you monitoring for, like, are you watching them in the news? Do you have, like, monitoring set up at the specific application level for new code being pushed? Or does it just make itself apparent to you because you're living in that ecosystem?
Yeah. you just need to be in the ecosystem and sometimes order a product. It's just like, if you want to hack on Netflix, you should watch Netflix movies. And if you want to hack on Amazon, you should order every once in a while some product.
So do you use Amazon? I mean, like, is that something that you use often? Okay,
yeah,
nice.
Yeah. I bought a lot of stupid stuff.
It's important to use the product. Yeah. Do you deal with fatigue on the same target? Like where you just don't really want to look at these types of requests anymore, or like anything like that? Or is it pretty fresh?
Long term, no, because I take pauses. So for example, after the last live hack event, I took a pause of now, I think, for a week and some more days. So that's really important to me, because I also have a lot of other responsibilities. And so that's just recover time. If you run a marathon, you should recover from this marathon. There are only a few that can keep running those marathons, but I'm not part of that. I collab a lot, so it's not money I chase. It's not the points I chase. It's the fun I chase and the excitement of finding new types of bugs or learn and stuff. So you don't get fatigued if you learn something new. Even though
you're focusing on the right things.
Yeah. And if you don't find bugs, but you learn something new, then you still have some achievement there. And that's maybe one of the take homes I want to share in your podcast. Don't depend too much on bug bounty. There are some people who do it full time, which I'm looking up to. And that's amazing that you can do that. But from my perspective, I got four different other jobs, and that's also part of my personality income.
Four different other jobs. Yeah. Oh my gosh, Jonathan.
But that also makes it easier that if one thing collapses or you get too much fatigue from it, then you slow down on that one and try to figure out with the other jobs or the other stuff you do. It could be a sport, could be some sidekick you do. Developing stuff, a lot of bug bounty, they're starting their own startups at one point or their own products. I think that's really smart to do, because if you do bug bounties for 6 years full time, I'm not sure if I could do that. I don't think I do.
So for you, the reason you've been able to do this so long in a performant way is because you are not focusing on the nitty gritty pieces, aspects of it. And when you get tired, you're taking breaks and you're not putting stress on yourself to perform in the bug bounty world.
Yeah.
You're just chasing the fun aspect of it, right? Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. And I was super lucky though that I had some wild cards for the first Amazon hack event, which was a virtual one during COVID. And I managed to win that one. So then out of nothing, your first event, you win this MVH thing, and then you're like, oh, this was the top prize I could win. Okay, that's good. So I don't have to stress anymore. So
yeah, that was luck. You feel a little bit more secure in your position in that world as well. That's good.
Somehow.
Zed Shano got the first little certificate, but Jonathan Bowman, you know, got the MVH.
With all the prizes also, I think this one is... It is also Shano is one. So we during those events we collapsed fully. I think I might just add some more points on the first live hack event because I found some chain that we popped and he helped me out to do. But I had some more points. So I can say if you look at that from that perspective, I might be more MVH, but from my perspective, he's similar.
But you guys have a very legendary collaboration set up in place. And that's kind of what I want to stick to next is like, you know, how transparently are you guys sharing all of the techniques and stuff? Because at the end of the day, there's a lot of money on the line here.
Yeah.
And I know for sure that you have come up with a technique that, you know, didn't take any input from him and vice versa. And then you guys have to decide, okay, you know, if I give this to Zed Shano, or if I give this to Bowman, Dr. Bowman, then, you know, there's going to be some vulnerabilities that they find that I won't be able to just get and report myself. So, I mean, what does that trade-off look like for you? And how have you managed that over the past 6 years of collaboration?
Yeah, well, we do a lot of research together. So there's no problem there. If you share stuff, no. And it's also not super fancy what we do. So it's not like super high technical complex things. No, I sometimes go a little bit more deeper in some new techniques, and at the same time he also goes deep every once in a while. And if I tell him, oh, I will pause for a month, I'm very happy if he reports back finding some chain I created together with him. And sometimes we share it a little bit. It's just syncing in with each other. Like, hey, how does that feel? Yeah, it feels well. Okay, you got hands on this thing. I'll focus on this other life hack event. Have a good one. And then by the end of the week, he made a shit ton of good money. I'm at this life hack event, super proud on some high CTS aspect that took me 10 days to develop, and not with for the money, but just for the sense.
Well,
and that's okay. Think there, you should not chase money. I think that is the thing. And if you're thinking enough with each other and both are on the same page on that, and then then that stuff is not complicated.
Then the money will come too. I mean, at the end of the day, you're performing better together, and you're collaborating, and you are sharing that knowledge. And, you know, I think you said in an interview with HackerOne that I watched in prep for this podcast that a lot of the advancements that have been made in the medical industry have been made because of relentless sharing of information and trying to get that information out to everyone so that people can save lives and help people live more quality lives.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you've applied something similar here with this collaboration where you guys share, and that just continues to compound and compound and compound.
I think that's a good summary. And the best thing is that relationships should go over any virtual internet points or money or whatever. And that's just in a relationship with a partner in real life. Although I speak with Sean maybe as much as with Renee, my girlfriend. That's sometimes a funny thing. Sometimes it's the first person I speak to, and by the end of the day, the last person I speak to. Renee is already sleeping. But, yeah, you share a lot of stuff in life, and I don't have to worry. And that's maybe a good other take home thing is try to find a good bounty partner. A lot of people have them. Try to build up a trust relation with the other person. Sink in. If you feel like, hey, this feels uncomfortable, just bring it up and say, hey, what do you think about that?
Yeah. How should we communication?
Yes, communication. And also in my work as a doctor, that's the main thing. It's communication about if you do stuff wrong. If I did something wrong, I tell people I messed up. I did it with a good reason, but it wasn't good. Let's fix it. So
have there been, you know, in this commitment to communication, and you say, hey, does this feel good with you? Does this feel good with you? Have there been times where you guys have said, no, that doesn't feel good, and no, that doesn't feel good? And you know, you guys have a disagreement that you have to resolve at length?
No.
Really, it's been pretty smooth.
Yeah. But that is some luck in life that you run into people that are not complicated or not in the game for fame or money. No. Of course it pays the bills. So of course that's the thing. But by the end of the day, as you said, you're more together if you look for the long perspectives, and it also does not burn you out. There's a lot of benefits there.
Lots of pros to that. So swinging back around to the Amazon program itself, one of the things you had here in the list in the doc is that Amazon, one of the things that makes Amazon a great program is they have consistent payouts for certain bug types. Can you talk a little bit about why you really like that, and how that makes Amazon an amazing program?
So for all the people who work for program listening to your podcast, one of the key things you need to try to achieve is consistency. And that's also a hard part. Like, how do you apply CVSS? How do you rate certain bugs? How do you deal with some XSS that someone already reported, but you got a new report where there's a payload that does different stuff there, or approve account takeovers or stuff like that. And that's something that you can do as a program where you give the same answer multiple times in a row about certain bug types and be predictable. Take feedback from researchers like, hey, this might be odds that this payout is so much lower, or how do you feel about that? Or would it make sense if we change this? Would that be more interesting to you? And that conversation, if it keeps going and the leadership is there, also continuing the previous leaderships, that makes it a program consistent and less stressful as a researcher, because the last thing we like to see is that one day you get, say, 1K, then 3K, then 4K, then 1K, and then you start asking yourself, like, what's the difference? Is the weather?
And it feels like our work is discredited as well. Like, sometimes you could be really proud of a bug, and then you're like, ah, wow, you really don't see that. And that's disappointing.
Yeah, so that is the perspective you need from a bug bounty hunter. You feel some, you want a reward, and you want to be a consistent reward, because otherwise you might doubt, like, hey, is it less good? Or
I think that's probably one of the reasons that Amazon has been able to keep so many anchor hackers like you and Zichano, is that they have their thing, and they stick to it, and they pay the bugs and that sort of thing. And you can become very consistent then, and you can really understand the threat model of an organization and of an application very thoroughly. And that just feels, it just clicks, right? You know, when you get these bugs paid and they're paid the same way time and time again, you can really feel like you've got mastery of a specific set of a program or a set of applications.
Yeah, you understand way better what they find important to them. And also you understand more and more how to report certain stuff, or what is necessary for them to see in a report that makes them like, okay, this needs to get priority. Because by the end of the day, we don't want... We want the proper CVSS or rating for a bug, because that helps also in getting stuff fixed. Well, that's more an ethical perspective, but I think it's an important one. So sometimes I'm fighting some downgrading of a bug, not only because, well, it earns maybe a little bit more money, but to be sure that's on the top of their list to get fixed, and that everyone got a true understanding of the real impact. And a last thing about that is that it's super important with big companies like Amazon's, but also all the other big companies on the stock markets, is that you tend to have people moving around the company after 3-4 years. So there's a thing that if you work for a certain big company, you need to have some career path. And that's a hard thing, because we as bug bounty hunters have to deal with different phases, different teams, new leadership, etc. So, and that's something that Amazon achieved quite well, is to keep the mindset the same as it was 6 years ago. The same sort of people are working in their leadership positions. And what I observe now doing bug bounties for a while is that you see programs changing so fast into great programs turning into programs with a lot of problems. And it might be money, because less budget, might be changing of people working for the teams. So try to get some permanent positions, seniors, people who understand our position as a researcher, but also understand the internal problems, and then you have a great program.
Yeah, I think that's super important. Even in just the, you know, year and some change that I've been running this podcast, year and a half, I've said some great stuff about programs, and then, you know, come back a year later and it's like completely different experience because of turnover and because of changes within the organization. So that consistency, I think, is huge from a people level as well. And it's something that I think extends beyond just the realm of security as well. I think it's sort of a problem with tech in general right now, is that there's so much turnover and so much job hopping to climb the ladder and that sort of thing, where people just need to pay more money and you know, or have a consistent schedule to go up, so that these people don't have to jump around from job to job to job and relearn a new system every like 2 or 3 years.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's intense, man. I think with that, I think we'll move into some of the more technical aspects. I'm very excited that you have agreed to release some of the information about this server-side template injection vulnerability on FileSender with us on the pod today. So thanks for doing that. Can you talk a little bit about that bug and how you found it and how it can be exploited.
So FileSender is a quite interesting piece of software. It's used for the last, well, maybe 15 years, I think. It's really old. When I was in university doing med school, I used it, and it's used in the Netherlands and all university and other colleges to send around files, because we did not have file send of WeTransfer and the other solutions at the time. So university figured out, let's open source the tool ourselves, and we called FileSender so you can find it on GitHub. It's a quite interesting tool since, well, you can connect SSO, some logging thing, so students can log in and then people can upload stuff, and you can send someone else a link or an email with the content. And it works quite well. But in the recent years, they also added some extra services behind it. So S3 is supported now, so that's good for storage. AWS.
Additional layers of complexity as well, though.
Yeah, through that. And I have good contacts within the InfoSec community of the universities in the Netherlands. We've got sort of one internet service provider called SURF. Amazing people working there. And they reached out to me like, hey, John, we are thinking of rolling out a full new version of FileSender, FileSender 3. And we did a lot of pen tests already. We think it's quite secure, but can you have a final look at it? And being quite busy with the Lifehack events, I had it somewhere on my list, but I, to be honest, forgot about it. So I got a reminder from one of the people working there, and like, John, you should have a look. Really, do it. So I was like, okay, let's do that. So I asked them, like, hey, do you have any...
Amazing that you fit this in, dude. Amazing that you make this happen. I don't understand. Continue, sorry.
Yeah, and so I was like, can you spin up a machine where it's running so I can first do some black box testing before I dive deep into the source code? And what we do as bug bounty hunters, we look for unauth stuff first, because that has the highest impact. So what types of stuff can we find? And quite quickly, I figured out there were certain error messages. And those error messages came up within the URL some base 64 coding. And I decoded that, and I figured out, hey, there's some templating stuff going on there. Yes, I saw some template codes. But then I tried to think, like, why did I do that? And the reason for that was they have different university, different logos, different temp designs. So in emails, they want to give different logos, for example, and also to expose, like, where's the actual base URL and what's the base URL and stuff like that. And I could see that I could manipulate the error message enough. And then I just started looking in the code. In one of your previous podcasts, it's like, where's the request? Was one of the main changing things of math.
Where's the request game? Yeah, I love that.
Where's the error came from? And so that was the thing I tried to do. So I just literally download the zip file from GitHub, unpacked it, opened it up in VS Code, and just did console shift F and searched all the files for the error message, actually, that was there. So after a few clicks, I figured out where's the loop that tries to replace those templates tags in error messages, figured out where it was. So no complex debuggers with PHP storm or something. No, just looking in the code. And I thought there was also a config template variable that was used for the paths, the server paths, actually. So where could I download, so where should it write temporary files or something like that? The next moment you do, when you find that, you immediately look for what other config variables are existing. And then you figure out, oh, wait a minute, MySQL database user and password. So no. I tried to do that, and I saw the username and password, and I was like, oops, Isn't that good?
And that's not good. More, dude, how far are you into this assessment? Like, is this like you just
7 minutes
checked it out for? Thoman, please.
Yeah, so it's just getting an error. And I'm like, hey, base 64. As soon as we see base 64, it's like eczema on the skin. We understand, like, there's something off going on there, and we need to get you a cream. And in this situation, we need to look at your discount. Why should you use base 64 now? So that was the first thing. And then, it was quite easy to figure out. And this new version also has S3 support. So I saw that I could dump the scripts and the access key of the S3 bucket, giving full access to the file system. So I reported back to them, like, hey, there's a problem with your version 3. You might need to have a double look, an extra look at that. And then a few hours later, I was like, but if it's in the latest version, why is it not in the currently used version? So I looked into the source code, and you got this thing, git blame, where you can see how old the commit is.
I love that.
And this commit was 10 years old. And I was like, oh shit. This thing is already hanging around for 10 years. And
Man.
So I looked into the production version of the one used by my university, and I figured out that they were vulnerable. I could just see the S3 key and access token and all the stuff. Geez. So I tried to log in on the bucket just to prove impact. And yes, I could access it. So that was quite a complex problem, since this software is used in a lot of places, in especially education. But also some healthcare organizations are using it. Some big governmental organizations are using it. And then you have to start to do the responsible disclosure. And they did an amazing job. Since it's all open source thing, so it's all like people doing this as volunteers.
Are you working with the file sender team directly at this point, or are you working with that collective of,
and luckily enough, they were together with some conference in Paris, so they set up a call quite quickly. I got them through to understand where the bugs are existing. Then they tried to figure out how to hot patch this. That was quite hard because it's a templating thing, so it might break a lot. They start creating patches. They start monitoring if the bugs were abused, because it might be a zero day already discovered by someone else.
Sure.
And then the part two of the fun, it's fun for me as a bug bounty hunter. Not
I don't think they would describe that day as fun.
No. I mean, that's also the hardest part, is being a doctor. Sometimes you feel so excited finding this rare disease, but you have to understand at the same time, there's someone in front of you not happy. So learn how to cope with excitement on moments where that's difficult. But here, part two of the excitement comes. Was the moment they start developing the fix, this git commit bug was published.
Yeah.
Super interesting.
From TruffleSec, right? Was it them? I think so.
Yeah. Mm. So long story short, every fork in a repo is, even if the fork is hidden, the commit might be also hidden. But if you know the hash of the commit, some piece of it that is unique, then you can still view it. Somehow it is security through obscurity. So I figured out, like, hey, would be fun if they start trying to patch this bug and commit on the public repo. And
lo and behold, what happened.
So that's what I did. So I reached out to Lupin and to Trifold themselves, like, hey, I want to try this tool, how to do that? And Lupin, being a great talented hacker, already figured out pipelines and stuff. So he helped me a little bit there. And I run this script on some little Linux box for, I think, 2 hours, 3 hours in total. And I found the commits they made to patch this thing.
So, no way, dude.
So I had to reach out back to them again. It's like, hey, dudes, be aware that at this moment, a lot of GitHub commits are being scraped. And if it's not known, this patch, there is a risk that this patch is found by someone. And also the zero day is exposed, or one day, whatever you call it. So then we're like, oh no, you again. No.
What technique? Jonathan, no, get out of here. That's great.
But the way how you handle it is also, that is academics. That's why I work one day a week in academics, is there are also scientists, and are also like, oh shit, but this is cool. How does that work?
So, well, that's good. I'm glad that they appreciate it, because it is pretty cool stuff. And I was looking at, you know, when you sent me over this 10-year-old commit or whatever, I was kind of looking at the way that they patched it and stuff. And it's a little bit of an odd thing that they're doing, it looks like here, right? Because essentially the way that this vulnerability was working, if I understand correctly, was, you know, there would be an exception page that would be generated, and then you would pass a base64 encoded, you know, exception string or something like that into that page. And then that would get concatenated with a template, and then that template would be rendered, right? But they're still doing, it looks like, it seems like they've moved that user-controlled portion of that input into something different. So it's not getting concatenated into the template there. They've associated it with the session, but it still looks like they're dynamically rendering templates themselves, right? Like it's different from actually taking a template and you know, rendering it. It's dynamically creating a template then that you will then render, which I think is just a little bit of a weird way of doing things. So I wonder if there are more server-side template injection bugs on this software, because I mean, like you said, it's pretty widely used, I believe. Yeah. So I think there could be more things there. Do you have any plans to continue looking at it further?
Oh, or? Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I tried to break it. I was not able to break the patch. If one of your listeners is, please reach out to their teams and to the search behind files. And I think it's also on the main repos. If you open it up there, there's ways to get in touch with the owners. And if you got struggles, always feel free also to reach out to me. But filecenter.org, it is, I think, filecenter.org. Yeah, that's the way you should go. So, and then contact. So, yeah, if someone finds something there might be still a way to do this, but I'm not experienced enough, I think, to do that. So, help the research world, help academics.
It's a little funky.
And you don't earn big money. That's the thing. Yeah. But you earn some, you know, the thing of doing good for human mankind, and maybe some stickers, some t-shirts, whatever.
Maybe some stickers or t-shirts. Yeah. That's good. You're planning on doing the blog post as well in conjunction with this pod, right? You're going to drop that, or is it going to be okay? Solid. Yeah. So we'll have a blog post down in the description. I'll call that out now when we release this episode, and then we'll probably put the POC somewhere up here on the screen or something like that as well, so that you guys can understand exactly what's happening. But I was reading through some of your other bugs as well, Jonathan, and I actually see, you know, a trend of server-side template injection, which is just really a weak bug for me. Like, I've only ever found server-side template injection like once or twice. So what are you doing that is making you find these server-side template injections? I know that in one of your articles, you mentioned a custom burp scanning profile that helps with that. Are you just spraying the payloads around, or are thinking about it from a templating perspective? What's going on there?
I try to use the burp active scanner in such a way that it only scans for useful stuff. And I think there's a lot of trainings around on how to use burp and how to use all the different options. But I think the most important part is how to use the active scanner in such a way that is useful. And there are a few steps I always take. First, I look at the target. I try to figure out what coding language is behind it. Sometimes there are multiple ones. It's like a reverse proxy somewhere on an endpoint. Sometimes it's one. And especially with the old coding languages like Perl and the ancient ones, there you want to be sure that it's part of your active scan. And often, bookbound vendors turn them off, the active scanner, because they get your banned on Akamai or whatever. It's too noisy. And they forget to turn it on, or if they turn it on, they only turn on the XSS or server interaction types of stuff. But if you toggle on the template injections, the per code injection, and that's what it's called in the active scan, then you might end up with bugs that other people missed out. And so there's an interesting blog post on RCE I found on Ahold's, one of the biggest food companies in the world, Ahold Delhaize. And the only way I could find that was because I had my Burp configured to also scan for Perl code injections. And they get some payload that does, does some sleep or proof it there is code injection. To show impact, you need to start coding Perl, which I can't do myself. So
dude, so terrible. so terrible.
So genetic. So now you need to figure out which ChatGPT your old friends.
Our old friends.
to get some use out of that.
Savage.
You end up with good stuff. But that is a way. Another way is try to understand how the templates are rendered. So for certain targets, Amazon, for example, I know exactly what types of strings they use for templates. And a lot of other targets I also know. And you can discover by looking at not properly rendered pages, for example. And that's you need to be lucky there. So look in your sitemap, look for the generic template types of how you write the template codes.
Yeah, angle brackets and angle that brackets. Sort of thing.
Yeah. And then figure out, okay, those are the angle brackets they use. Okay, this is an example of what actually also renders a proper variable. And then you might put that in your word list for your own custom scans. So that's the way to go.
I noticed also in this write-up that you did with Ahold USA that you first brute forced for parameters on this specific endpoint, and then you did the scan, and that scan uncovered the Perl injection. Is that something that you have a part of your flow pretty often, is identifying each individual endpoint and then brute forcing parameters on those endpoints?
Correct. Yeah. The challenge for us as bug bounty hunters is to discover untouched functionality, and query string parameters, form parameters that are not mentioned in the JavaScript, not mentioned anywhere, but are doing something on the code. That's where you want to look, because other people miss that out. You need to have some flow.
Are you using ParamMiner for that, or are you mostly just using Intruder like you are in this article?
I've got a hate relationship with ParamMiner, hate love thing. So I turn it on as everyone, and then I turn it off after 20 seconds, and then I turn it on again, and then I turn it off because it never stops.
Right.
If someone can fix a version of ParamMiner that actually behaves and doesn't go rogue and everything, that will be super helpful.
What do you mean by go rogue? Are you talking about how it adds cache poisoning or canaries or whatever to all the different requests, or what are you talking about?
I might need to read the manual. Yes, I might tick the wrong boxes there. But often for me, it slows down, it hangs. So that's maybe the thing. Amazon, I would not recommend you to use ParamMiner, for example. It will give you a lot of headaches.
Gotcha. And so what you're looking for in those scenarios is just something maybe that has a little bit more feedback, so you can see whether it's slowing down or whether it's not slowing down or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then you are hoping, to be able to stop it and start it pretty easily. Is that the main problem that you see with that right now? Yeah.
See what are the thoughts. But that's the same with the active scanner of Burp. You should rule out any path with JPEGs, with images, for example, or fonts or CSS. There's not much there. So, and if you don't do that, it will try to do Perl code injection on a CSS file, which makes no sense. You need to limit it heavily to be effective. And this blog post on Owl, I showed that you can also use Intruder. If you got a feeling this page must be vulnerable, just go manually. I almost automate nothing of what I do. I just look carefully about what's going on, what's happening.
So, code. so let's say you identify a cool, funky looking request. You send it to a repeater or whatever.
Yeah.
You're playing around with it. Do you pretty much instantly send it to Intruder as well and launch off and then let that run for a little while, look at the responses that are different, and then keep playing with it? That's the flow.
Yeah. Yeah. And yes, at one moment, six different intruders, and you keep refreshing them and you keep looking at them. And then, you're lost on your screen. And then you think like, okay, I got 20 repeater tabs and now 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 windows of intruder. Help.
Oh man. Yeah. There definitely needs to be some organization stuff that is a little bit different in that area.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool though. So I think server-side template injection is definitely a tricky one for me. I definitely want to grow in that area. I don't have a good flow right now for using a scanner that would alert to that sort of thing. Mostly the way that I should be doing it, but I'm not, is just putting these, curly brackets or angle brackets or whatever into a part of the like XSS payloads that I'm using and spraying across the website. Is that something you're doing as well? Or are you mostly relying on the scanner to detect that?
No, that totally makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Solid.
And then you still have the challenge of a lot of template engines are custom stuff like FileSender is a great example where you need to know the specific way they write their template tags. And if you don't use it in a proper way or with a variable that's not existent yet, then you might miss the injection. So yeah, if you're able to try to figure out some real working co-blobs.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So pivoting a little bit, you mentioned before that one of the early things you did early with Amazon was breaking apart the Android mobile app and kind of diving into that a little bit, understanding how the APIs work to build this website or whatever that was going to make you a millionaire. And I think you've done a pretty good job as well, just looking, like talking to you at the Lifehack events and seeing the kind of bugs you're finding, of looking at that peripheral scope of Android and iOS. And I think a lot of people go down the Android route, but not as many people go down the iOS route. So can you talk about your methodology with iOS apps and how you're approaching that to attack these bigger organizations?
Yeah, so it's really important, I think, as a big bounty hunter to have an iPad that is jailbroken and to have an Android that you can use to easily man in the middle. Because if it's too big of a hassle to man in the middle all those apps, you don't do it or you lose too much time. If it's super easy to do, then you, for example, in a Lifehack event, you get the new scope. You see, okay, we've got 6 apps there. We've got some websites. Okay, let's install all those apps right now on my iPad and on my Android. Wait for 5 minutes and then come back and then just start trying to man in the middle then and see what's traffic. So my methodology is I got an iPad that I jailbreak with Pillrain. Pillrain is one of those jailbreak tools, and there's still an iPad available that you can jailbreak with that tool that also updates to some of the latest iOS versions. I think it's the tablet iPad 7. So have a good look on the Pillrain website and see which models are still supported and if the model also supports one of the latest iOS versions, because that's a problem. You need to have recent versions. But the last time I checked was 3-4 months ago and it was still working well. So that's a thing. And I got a spare Android phone, Pixel thing that I rooted, but also with Android, you can easily use APK METM, APK Man in the Middle. It's on GitHub. So sometimes I just patch the APK and then I install it. But I also think here it's important to have those devices separate from your own device, because otherwise you end up with your personal phones full with strange apps. Or keep up your own security. So have those different devices there also really helps to open them up and update just all those apps and see which apps can be updated. So you get some signal back from like, hey, there's something new.
This is really interesting, this APK MITM tool that you mentioned here. I hadn't actually seen this before. I had seen something similar with called Objection, which allows you to patch APKs and then hook in via Frida scripts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But this actually seems like it's oriented specifically more towards like getting rid of serpinning and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
And it just goes for that. So it's like a one shot. Let me see if this works.
Yeah.
If it does, great. And then if not, obviously, I'm going to have to go down the custom route.
Yeah, and that's also sometimes I do. So then I go give it a try with Frida or Objection and try to patch it myself. There's only one time I was not able to disable the menu in the middle, and that was some heavily obfuscated app from some government somewhere on this planet.
So annoying, man.
that had, if I had to patch it, I had to patch it on system call level in iOS, and my good old friend ChatGPT was hallucinating too much to help me out there.
Oh, no.
So I got stuck in a lot of rabbit holes, and then I figured out, okay, I might need to wait for other people to figure out how to do this properly. But most of the time, APK, man in the middle thing works or Objection. And then the fun starts. Then you need to use the app and just see what's going on and is there any hidden functionality. Do you need to, are you able to get some perks if you are an artist or if you sell stuff or whatever you can
get
think
the app
of.
Configured in general. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So that's most of my time I spend on is understanding how an application works or where are the edge cases.
I really like what you said here is get some framework in your brain for both Android and iOS where it reduces friction to get to the man in the middle point, right? Because a lot of the value for us as web hackers is looking at these APIs and what kind of different APIs the mobile app is using as compared to the web, right? And so if you have a system in place, okay, you know, we download the APK on the device, we pull it off with ADB, we run, you know, MITM APK or whatever the name of the thing is to patch it. And then we send it along, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, fine. You know, just having that in place and not having to think about that whole thing and the same flow for iOS opens up scope for you when it's easy. And when it's not, you can go a different route or you can choose to double click in.
Exactly. And one other important advice is have two of those tablets, because one day one will break and you will have a lot of stress. So I got two iPads, I got two Pixels, and that removes all the stress for me that if something is bricked, because it's all jailbreaks, it's all, that's, you try to update them and then see if Pillrain still works, and you don't want to endure this moment of truth. No, you want to say like, okay, I got my backup here, it's working. If I break this one, I still got my backup there. So that's also an important lesson I learned.
I imagine that helps as well for like cross-user testing. Like you don't have to go log out of the app on this one and log into it on that one. And like, all right, now I'm just trying to use two sessions on one iPad. You know, it's like, oh, geez.
Exactly. Mm.
I think it's worth the investment.
On a refurbished iPad. It's all refurbished, those models. So it costs nothing. You can buy them on Amazon.com.
Buy them on Amazon.
This was not sponsored by Amazon.com. Please click my affiliate link below.
Give up your dream, Jonathan. You're never going to become an Amazon affiliate. Oh my gosh.
That's what it is, man. Quick. No. But you can, it costs nothing. And it saves you, if it saves you 2 hours of headaches or stress, then you get your money back.
Very much worth it.
Yeah.
Very much worth it. I'm looking through some of these other things here on the list, and I think next place you've got two more cool bugs that I want to go through. This chain of three bugs in the healthcare Dutch healthcare system stuff, and that also sort of leads us down the path of why the threat model changes with the different industries that you're in, right? And I think a lot of times in the bug bounty world, we are very much used to POC or GTFO sort of things. But I think this Medium article that you wrote up on people being able to send executable files through a portal that was meant for sending patient information can have tremendous amount of impact. So can you talk to us a little bit about that assessment and the vulnerabilities you chained together for that one?
Yeah, so I tried to bring back everything I learned from book bounties in healthcare just to improve and make the industry more mature on the InfoSec thing. And one day I decided to see how a feasible ransomware attack would look like in Dutch healthcare. So being a GP myself, I'm quite vulnerable. I got a lot of patient data. I got a lot of colleagues running around, a lot of clients. And so I started with having a look at one of the biggest insurance companies in the Netherlands. I'm also insured by them for my legal problems. And at the time, they did not have any responsible disclosure policies, but they are like, an organization founded by doctors. So I expected them to be ethical doctor friendly. So there's one problem there is that they also sell insurances for cyber risk and ransomware attacks, where they give a guaranteed payout for ransomware attacks of 100K plus. So if you insure yourself for a few hundred bucks, then if you got ransomware, then they will pay the ransomware group, which is a problem because in my industry, there's no money. So if you ransomware me, you get a box of candies with not traceable candies, because that's all we have in our practice. there's no big money floating around there. And
you've brought those Netherlands candies to the Life Hacking events before. It's like, what is it, like the black licorice or something?
It's Zolt Mix.
I don't like that. Yucky.
Good that you remember that. You are fond of the stroke baffles, I guess.
I am. Yeah. Those are very good. Those approved.
Yeah, there you go. So I figured out, like, hey, they're creating a big risk to my industry. They obviously do it because people request them to sell those insurances. So it's a complicated problem, but my perspective was, that's not good. But also, like, they're the first main targets I would like to hack as a ransomware group, because if I hack them, I know exactly who's insured for which amount of money. And that will be my dream come true, because then I can pinpoint my attack.
So you're hacking the insurance provider to understand, okay, this company all have insurance policies at 100 grand. So I need to go pop that one and that one and that one and that one.
There you go. So that was the moment when I discovered that, like, oh wait, this might be a thing, then I start poking more into their infrastructure. If I'm a client, but I had to be super careful because I did not have permission, no responsible disclosure thing there. Just so I was more doing this to do good for society, being some sort of journalist. I'm publishing about security issues, so I've got some protection in the Netherlands, but I need to be careful. So I ringed up my mom. My mom is a psychologist. And I asked her, like, are you also insured with them? And she was like, yeah, I am. So at that moment, I had two accounts. On my left screen, I had my mom active. On my right screen, myself. So I was able to safely IDOR my own account from my mom's. And if, shit hits the fan and whatever happens with lawyers and judges, and I could at least say, yeah, I did try to only impact myself, and I did to try to do etc. And in the Netherlands, you're quite safe if you do that. So that's when I opened up Burp, see how it all works. And then I figured out, hey, there's some inbox with all your PDF documents that request has some integer of your membership number. And I could replace my mom's membership number with mine. And that way I could steal all the cells that were part of my profile, including the insurance policy term sheet. So, so I reached out to them, and they handled this really well. So they patched this bug within hours or a few days, and they reached out to me to discuss how they can improve the overall security. By the end of a few weeks, they also published a responsible disclosure. Had to convince leadership there that it's a good idea to get transparency. And I think Yogurt once put that on Twitter, transparency is trust. And that is one of the most important parts, I think, in our society, in our book bounty programs, in But also from a customer perspective, I want to know if something went wrong and how you handled it. And if you learned something from it, it's all good. So I tried to convince them also to let me share the story. And after some debate, they agreed on that. And so that's the proper route to go.
It's really good to enforce change, you know, via that, by bringing it to the public and that sort of thing. And I think especially in these very high data sensitivity in industries, it's super important to have at minimum a responsible disclosure program.
Yeah.
Otherwise, how are people going to be able to report stuff? And dude, it's so common. I've actually found almost an identical bug to the one in your write-up here within the past month on a healthcare thing in the US, where it's literally just up in the URL bar, you know, member ID equals, yeah, you know, numeric IDOR. And it's like, this is really not good.
Yeah.
And there's no way we're the only one seeing this, right? Like, no. there are definitely other people that look up there and say, if I'm member ID 123, then somebody else is going to be member ID 124. And that's not good.
How did it went when you recorded this? Was it part of a bug bounty program or responsible?
No, it wasn't a part of a bug bounty program. It was something that I used. And so I went in there and I was like, I opened up this PDF file. I exported it so that I could, you know, do something with it. And, you know, in the PDF export, of course, there's like a, you know, they like / PDF renderer, whatever. And just put in the ID and it generates the output. And I looked at it and I'm like, oh no. So I sent an email and I to their support team, because they didn't have any security contacts. And then I called the company and said, hey, I just sent through an email. And they're like, we don't really know what to do with this. And I'm like, that's fine. You know, it's not you. Just can you pass it to somebody in IT, please? And they fixed it within 24 hours, which was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, they no email back, no response, no nothing. Just
yeah, and that's a super important thing. We need to push more for, as a society, to all the people creating like the laws, all the people in working for governments, try to see what you can do to get every piece of infrastructure that holds data of citizens of your country, that they have some way of it, that there is some way to reach out to this infrastructure to report security bugs to, but also try to see if you can enforce or support transparency, because enforcing stuff is not good because people will find ways around. But if you share the reason why we need to be transparent about stuff, then you also create more awareness on all levels. Like, hey, we might need to bend that something every once in a while. Hey, we might need to check something for the risk before we deploy it. Or that will protect us from people who want to do harm. And in the healthcare industry, ransomware is our biggest threat at the moment. They are super smart. They've got really big budgets. I bet they already fixed my PyroMiner book, and they were like, "Oh, yeah, we have fixed that already because of their budget." But we got so much stuff exposed on the internet. I mean, if it's hard to reach out to companies, like, you have to go through all the hoops. Yeah, that's work to do, and maybe not our work, but we need to ask
somebody from the policy side, you know.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I haven't seen a ton of is, in like, pretty much only I've seen this from Jack Cable here in the US, and you over there in the Netherlands as well, is trying to get involved with the policy creation and trying to influence that at a big scale. I think that's really important work and will make it easier for us to do these sort of things in the future and continue to move forward with, you know, reporting these bugs and getting them addressed in a way that's also
good. Get you rewarded for your investment of time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
I mean, people aren't just going to, you know, people aren't going to do it just for free forever, you know? And and so there should actually be some additional monetary incentive, I think, as well.
Yeah. I fully agree on that. Yeah. Yeah, so that was the first hit. So we now know in the Netherlands, everyone who was insured, we should hesitate for or pinpoint our target or attack some. The second book I found was, in the Netherlands, as a doctor, you need to have some subscription with a person that will handle all your complaints. So if you're not happy with me, you can file some complaint against me, and then this independent person will try to mediate and try to figure out how could we learn from it. So it's not like a legal procedure. It's more like get stuff fixed and get stuff done in a proper, quickly way. But most doctors use their private details for that because they want to be aware of any problems as soon as possible. And we receive this stuff just with the ordinary old mail. So that was my next target. It's a super small organization, two people working there, but they have a lot of sensitive data. All the doctors, but also the psychiatrists working in prisons and stuff like that. They hold all the data. And they had a fun book that if you signed up for a new profile, everyone could sign up. And you entered your registration number as a doctor. They call it BIG number, but it's just an integer code that's public. You can find it everywhere. I need to share it also with you. If you ask me, it's the way you can check if I'm actually a doctor. If you enter that in your new sign up profile thing, they return an error like, sorry, you already have a profile. Please log in. But if you look in Burp, you saw in the response the full account details.
Oh, they also put it in the response.
So take home message here. Always check your Burp for any responses. They might not render it on the website, but it's there in the response. So also they handled it pretty well and quickly, and they patched it. But at that point, we had all the private data of all the doctors, also the doctors having this really good insurance policy. We have a coverage for a lot of money if you want to wear them. First, we need to actually upload the malware to their systems. And the easiest way these days is just send an email with an attachment. That's my homeless answer, but that's not fancy. So we had to look for something fancy. So there are like 7 systems in the Netherlands. EHR systems, like we use as GPs.
Sure.
And I got access to a few of them, and one of my GP buddies, Bart, is also sometimes hacking. So I reached out to Bart, and I was like, hey, dude, do you've got any, which systems could you test for me? He was like, yeah, I got access to 2 of them. It's okay, good. So we have coverage on about half of all the systems. So I explained him the thing, and he was like, yeah, I can try that for you. So you want to upload an executable instead of a picture of the XMAP thing. Oh yeah, makes sense. So all our clients can send messages through some portal app and can upload and picture. So it's easy for me to have like, it's nothing. At this screen. So that moment, me and Bart start trying to upload executables, and most of them got blocked because there are some men in the middle party that is doing a lot of those portals. But one of them did not block it. So then we discovered like, we could just upload an executable. And for me as a doctor, the executable is displayed in my inbox of a Windows desktop application, all custom, all Java, I think. It's really ancient legacy software. And I could just click it and it opened up the executable. And we did a proof concept with some setup.action, nothing fancy, no ransomware there. But we proved that we could just send those executables to specific doctors. You can sign up as a ransomware group to any doctor you want to. There's no real no user. What we call privilege required. That will be none or low, maybe, but I would say none.
Oh my gosh!
And so that was RCE there. User interaction required, but still good thing.
So I mean, essentially, what you did is something that we talk about, you know, on the pod from time to time here, is building out that full threat model vision, that full attack vector vision, right? You started with enumerating all of the, doctors and that have these insurance policies, and then you figure out a way to actually get that payload through to the doctor in a way that's reasonable. And I mean, that this is beautiful. This is really beautiful, because at the end of the day, it makes it so much clearer for, the people that are not in this bug bounty world, or even people that are in the security world, but not in like the full, let me pock out this whole thing world, how easy it is to put these pieces together and achieve some really crazy impact. I mean, this is exactly how a malicious actor would go about this, right?
So this is also
if they were to do it programmatically.
For programs, I think. If you want to be a great program, just say the scope is our customer data. Figure a way out how to hit it, and no phishing, because that's too easy, but think out of the box. And to do that, the only way to do it is if we've got proper policies in countries where you are not limited by other companies suing you because you found a bug in their systems. No, we need to create a way that we technically create those chains, because it's not only amazing stories, but it is actually the way it works in real life with the with the threat models we have to work with. So,
I think this is really good. I think this is something that a lot of programs could really do better on. Some programs will put treasure maps out there and say like, hey, we care about this, we care about that. But I think incentivizing full-fledged attack methodology is really cool. So saying like, hey, if you can provide some way to show a vulnerability, show distribution and exploitation of this vulnerability in mass, then we'll award additional bounties for that, or we'll award bonuses for that, or we'll have a set, you know, tier or whatever that you reach to. If you're able to provide me with a reasonable attack vector that chains things together and makes this attack that somebody could very easily implement.
Exactly. And a mistake I see programs now making is to put third-party code or stuff like that, or enterprise software out of scope. If you do that, you lose big talent. Because there are some researchers focused on that, finding your zero days in your enterprise software that holds all the sensitive data you can think of. So start doing that. Take responsibility for the stuff you implement in your company. It's your decision to use this enterprise software, and be aware of any bugs. And if it's a zero day, you want to know. And if it's a one day, you might also want to know. And it's the change that will be the ones that impress leadership and in the end also protect your customers or your clients, whatever employees. So
a lot of times these enterprise softwares, I think they were actually just discussing this last week on the Asset Note podcast, Surfacing Security, about how these third-party vendors are really becoming the shadow IT of this generation, and oftentimes the weakest links are not this code that are part of the main application, but these little vendors that they're like, we kind of need this tool, but we don't like fully vet it. We just kind of plop it in on the system. And then time and time again, you've seen Shubs and the whole Asset Note crew just destroy those pieces of software. And it's absolutely detrimental.
We need so many people like Shubs in this team. Shubs is one of the most impressive hackers I've met in my hacking career. Super grateful also to work together sometimes with him. And what he learns me is that there are so many weak spots in software that is used everywhere, but you need to invest heavily on that, and you need to go deep, really deep. And if we don't let that be part of the bug bounty game or our threat models, because if it's enterprise or it's third party, then you lose out on the most important bugs you might have. And I'm super happy that he is investing on that and doing great research.
It's very important, I think. All right, I want to be respectful of your time, Dr. Bowman, but I do have to ask a couple more questions about this. Okay, so moving away from the technical stuff and bringing it back around to something that I'm sort of tangentially passionate about with regards to bug bounty is how we as bug bounty hunters can take care of our bodies and take care of our minds as we're doing this very addicting, very, hunched over at our desk for hours sort of thing, right? So as the official doctor of the bug bounty world, tell us what we need to know about how to maintain our posture, how to keep our brains functioning, in these super long hacking sessions. What do you have for us there?
Yeah, it all starts with vegetables, sir. No.
Why do you just pull out a carrot?
As a bug bounty hunter, the most important part is to have a golden plate with carrots on it. It's the only way to have a constant way of finding bugs. Now, all jokes aside, have healthy habits. That's the most important thing. And habits, you create them by doing stuff periodically, two times a week. If you do that long enough, it becomes a habit, and if it's healthy, then it's good. So for myself, I've got the healthy habit of starting every other day, lifting weights. It's super boring. In the book what I see, I see quite a few powerlifters around us. I'm just a boring one. We're looking at the powerlifters like, how do you do that? I'm not dedicated enough to do this yet. But still, I created a healthy habit of going that and doing that. And doing this for a long while, I can't think of a situation where I'm not doing it. That's also a struggle with life hack events. Then you're in other environments and you sometimes don't have the ability to do those healthy habits, or you tend to not do that. So try to figure out how to do that. For me, for example, two YouTube channels I use often abroad are MadFit and Bully Juice. Just easy home gym stuff, which you can do without any extra. You can just do it on your hotel room. I discovered that during COVID because all the gyms closed down. I'm still using it by today. Eating, obviously everything you put in your mouth can be harmful. On the other end, life is short, so you might enjoy it. So don't be super strict in everything. Find the right balance. People sometimes ask me, like, hey, do you drink alcohol? Well, most of the time I don't. I might drink once a month, maybe once every three, 4 months max.
Yeah.
But that's one of the hacks I use to stay sharp and focused. I remember from the time I was a developer, and if I had some alcohol, I thought I had the greatest ideas. And if I look back on the code, it was horrible the next day. So that was a good objective observation of that it's not working well. Same with weed. I never smoke weed, even though I'm from Amsterdam. But something followed. Same with weed. I've never smoked weed in my life. For some people, it works, and there's quite a high rate of ADD or ADHD in bug bounty people having so that's often the reason people use weed to get some focus or some mind state that works for them. But also, there are other ways that are more healthy to do. So I'm not telling you you're doing wrong, but there's different ways to cope with the problem.
I'm not sure if this is your arena, because I know that like posture health and that sort of thing is something that's kind of different from, you know, general medicine stuff. It's more in the physical therapist realm. But I recently had an injury in my shoulder. And as I went to go talk to a doctor about it, you know, he was saying that from working at a desk, you know, the shoulders are sort of slunched forward like this a little bit. And because of that, the pectoral muscle is shortened and it's pulling the shoulder down. Right. And so one of the things that he had me do that it's been amazing for my posture and really helped with my ability to like reach and swing when I hit a volleyball is he's had me take like this ball, like a lacrosse ball or like a tennis ball, and like lean my chest up against a wall and push this ball into my chest muscle to loosen up this muscle right here. And that allows for this muscle to be extended a little bit more and allows for my back muscles to pull those shoulders back into place.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And I was like, man, this is the kind of stuff I need to know about, you know, like these hacks to keep the posture, you know, up straight when you're hunched over the computer normally, because I think a lot of us get so in the zone with bug bounty where we're like not even thinking about, you know, we're sitting like sideways and like, exactly all the levels IO stuff.
Invest in yourself and get a physiotherapist also. Maybe once you got some problems with posture, I try to sit in different positions all the time.
I've heard that's big, is changing the position that you're in, not just not any given position, but just changing on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah. So that worked for me, but it might not work for other people, but it works quite well for me. And in a lot of my jobs, I got to sit down, and in my work as a doctor, I sit on some strange odd chair that looks like if you sit on a horse. I'm not sure what the word for that is, but
like a saddle.
Yeah, like a saddle, and that also makes you like sit in all different ways, and that works for me. And with all the complaints you have, the thing is with muscles, it's the it starts with, if you have a problem, yeah, you can go to the fish therapy, get some massage, and then the problem is gone for a few hours and then comes back. So you need to learn how to stretch the muscle. You need to learn after that how to train the muscle. And if you improve the condition of all your muscles, you are less prone to catch another pain or problem. So that's why you also should start doing sports, even though you don't have any problems at the moment. Just to stay in the safe zone. And then we're getting older and older and older. And when getting older, stuff gets worn out, and that's part of life. But the only thing you can do is start training and keep training.
It's important to be consistent about it too, like you said, because for a really long time I was in the gym, you know, 5 days a week and lifting and that sort of thing. And then, you know, I've recently had a child in the family, and when you have that, things get a little bit difficult. You don't get as much flexibility in life, and so I stopped going to the gym, and stopped lifting as regularly, and. You know, it wasn't 6 months after that happened that I threw out this arm playing volleyball and dislocated my shoulder and had this whole problem start that I've been clawing my way back now for 1 month, you know, or longer than a month, actually, just trying to get this shoulder back in a position where I can use it. So, it's, you know, is a little bit of a tough lesson for me that even if you are, you know, lifting on a pretty regular basis, if you just stop for just 6 months, that's enough for the degradation to occur and for some injury to happen.
Yeah. So if your habits have, just like the iPads, have two of those iPads you can jailbreak, also have this thing
as a backup plan,
like the YouTube videos, and then you make the agreement with yourself, okay, if I can't go to the gym, I'll do this 30-minute workout just home. And so keep moving. And yeah,
it's a great idea. That's a great idea, Dr. Bowman. All right. Thank you so much for joining us, man. I appreciate it. So many different areas of wisdom across collaboration, across hacking, across health. Really a pleasure. Thanks for coming on the pod, man.
Thank you for the invite. And if anyone finds good bugs, hope to hear that on your podcast. If you find bugs on FileSender, let them know. They need more eyes. And happy to meet the people in the Discord, I think. I'm not sure if I joined already, but I'll have a look around. So feel free to reach out.
Thank you so much. That's the pod. Peace.